This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2014 podcast series. Today we are speaking with Dr. Ken Oliver about the current situation in Ferguson. Dr. Ken Oliver received his bachelor's degree in psychology and his master's degree in community counseling from Southeast Missouri State University in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. He received his PhD in counselor education from the Southern Illinois University. Currently, he serves as graduate program director and associate professor of counseling at Quincy University in Quincy, Illinois. He is a licensed professional counselor in the state of Missouri and has worked as a clinical mental health counselor in a variety of settings throughout his nearly 20-year stint as a mental health practitioner. A native of St. Louis, Dr. Oliver has a uniquely personal connection to Ferguson and the surrounding community. Welcome, Dr. Ken Oliver.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm really, really happy to be here with you.
Wonderful, wonderful. I'm going to dive right into the questions, and my first question for you is, where did you grow up in relation to Ferguson?
All right. I grew up it's approximately 7 miles from Ferguson in North St. Louis City. Mm-hmm. The intersection that I grew up on is Adelaide and West Florissant. Now that probably isn't going to mean anything to people that aren't from that area, but it's got a pretty rough reputation in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. So to try to put things into perspective. Usually when I tell other people from St. Louis where I grew up, if I see them out somewhere or meet at a conference or something like that, they usually look at me in disbelief. I don't know if they're questioning how I'm standing there without bullet holes in me, or I don't know what their question is, but they usually look at me and they're fairly surprised to be talking to someone from that area.
That survived.
That got out.
Yeah, that got out.
So the area was just infamous for being one of the most violent, poverty-stricken, drug and crime-ridden neighborhoods in the city for years and years, and still is to this day. So if you've been watching the news as it relates to Ferguson lately, you probably heard the street name of West Florissant quite a bit. Mm-hmm. West Florissant actually runs all the way from the city. It comes from North Florissant and changes into West Florissant right around my old neighborhood in the city, mm-hmm. and then runs north into neighborhoods in St. Louis County that are right adjacent to Ferguson. Mm-hmm. So it runs pretty much from the city all the way out through the county. So many of the protests that people have seen on TV, they've actually occurred on West Florissant, mm-hmm. partly because there are a lot of businesses there. There's lots of visibility. Mm-hmm. Another way to look at Ferguson, if you've been in the St. Louis area at all, is to think about going. If any of you have ever been to Lambert International Airport, you've pretty much been in Ferguson. Ferguson mm-hmm. sort of is right around the airport in that area. So a lot of what's going on, you've been there, and you've probably seen some of the parts of the streets where these things have been occurring.
What do you want people to know about this area? You know it better than most people who are going to be listening to this podcast. So what do you want us to know about this area?
Well, I think the biggest thing that people need to know that aren't from here, and people that are from St. Louis, particularly people from that area, know already is that Ferguson, despite what you may see on television, is actually a suburb. This is the burb. So inner city parents for years have aspired to move to Ferguson. I mean, since I can remember, simply for the opportunity for better schools, to get away from continuous violence and drugs encountered in the city. While Ferguson was only 7 miles away from my home growing up, it was a lifetime away in terms of opportunity, in terms of the school districts, in terms of things that it could be accomplished in that area. So people gave blood, sweat, and tears to actually get their kids to that area, to get them to a better life, a safer life. So it represents somewhat of an irony that we're seeing this thing come out of Ferguson, this kid being shot in Ferguson. Mm-hmm. I mean, people moved there because they didn't want to hear gunshots. They didn't want to hear sirens through the night. They had access to safer hospitals. They had access, ironically, to safer walks to the store. Mm-hmm. And I have told people in the last week or so, this situation is again, it's ironic because where I grew up in St. Louis area, I mean, we would have saw a police officer if a white cop would have been in our neighborhood. There's no way we would have stopped and talked to them. We would have run because we would have thought it just out of fear that there was something wrong. Not because we did anything wrong, but there was something wrong in the situation.
Right, you
It would
want
have
to
been
get
that out of
away.
place. We would have tried to get away. But in that area, it isn't ironic in the sense that I would expect that most of those parents and most of those children would feel safer. They would feel as though the police presence in that area, and we don't know what the situation is going to how the situation is going to play out, but many people had the expectation, and they had the expectation of safety being out in that suburban area, and we're finding out, and as much to many people's dismay, that that may not necessarily be the case. So I think that's where some of the frustration and the concern is coming in. I think what we're seeing is in large part a manifestation of fear as a community.
For the you spoke about irony and what impact do you believe this has on the happening since this young man's death? And also for the few people who don't know about what happened in terms of this young man's death, can you also describe that for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think again the community safety has been called into question. So in any sort of fear response, you see a variety of different behaviors come out. You may see anger, you may see frustration, you may see obstinance, agitation, and some of those things are coming out since this young man's death, in large part because I think that as a community, we've known in the black community that there's police brutality. There is sort of this innate fear of police. That has all been there. We've known about that over time. This is nothing new. To even have a young man be murdered by or shot by the police, there's nothing new there. The question I think here and is causing so much fear and concern is that I think people thought that this was a place that this would not be happening. This is a place where they would be safe. And on top of that, I mean, a big part of what I'm seeing that has occurred both through personal experience and through just talking to other family members, and most of my family is in that area. So many of my family members that have been able to move out of the city, they move right into one of the surrounding communities of Ferguson, Florissant, Delwood, Hazelwood. Of course, these don't mean anything to anyone else that hasn't been in that area. But they're surrounding suburban communities, primarily black communities that are right there, right around the airport. But the immediate police response has really done very little to quell. In fact, many would suggest that it's simply acted to exacerbate the community's fear associated with how the police deal with things.
And isn't it also, it's going on longer than everybody thought it would.
Right,
What is
right.
that about, Ken?
I think that's sort of what I'm talking about. I mean, in terms of, I think part of it is that people want some sort of rapid response. They want to know what's going to happen with this police officer, and the people don't like the way that the situation's been handled. But we're seeing, I mean, if you're on social media and you're following people that have been in that community, you're seeing people consistently talk about the different sort of oversteps of people that are policing the area even now. My sister's right there, and she calls me, and we talk about this stuff all the time, and she talks about just sort of feeling trapped in the community and not being able to go out when you want to and things like that, and not being able to protest peacefully and all those kinds of things. So we've had discussions almost on a daily basis about what's going on, and I've been back and I've seen a few things that just sort of questionable, but I mean,
Can you
and I
describe
understand their
one,
side of
or
things too.
can you give
Huh?
us
Say it again.
an example of one of the things you've seen?
Well, just for example, people being moved. I mean, we were out and walking around, and people just sort of being moved from one side of the street to the other. But just silly little things, basic things that if they were trying to get people to calm down, that they they probably wouldn't do. Just simple little silly things that just seem a bit excessive. That's really all. But I mean, again, I understand that the need to promote calm and to protect the people that are there, and I understand all of that. So,
I know there are some disagreements in the counseling community about what counselors can do to help. Of course, as counselors, we would love to help. How can counselors become more involved in Ferguson?
Well, I think one of the criticisms that I've had is of the profession in general is this whole multicultural movement, even really since it started, since inception, that we sort of, if you look at back at the literature, we talk about, well, we want to become more multiculturally confident because we're going to have this influx of diversity in the future and things like that. I agree with that sort of on a professional side in order for us to sort of stay relevant as a profession, but there's sort of a humanness that's lacking from that. So to see people sort of come to the fight once this comes out, I question it. It makes me question it a little bit, just me personally about, is this sort of a genuine thing that's going to be long-lasting? So for counselors, I think that really coming into this and understanding that this may have an effect on people a lot longer than just the next couple of weeks. This may have effects on in terms of a person's racial identity development, for example. So you have a young black male that comes in, let's say, and they used to be somewhat oblivious to any sort of racial tension, any sort of socio-political history associated with race, and this situation in itself, it sort of makes them question. It sort of gets them into a place where they have some dissonance about, well, I'm black too, so what does that mean for me when I encounter the police, or what does that mean for me when I encounter people that have been posting on forums, online. Those kinds of questions begin to sort of prompt people into sort of deeper self-examination when it comes to this, and that will have a tremendous effect, really, in terms of a person's mental well-being, how they view themselves, how they develop their own personal identity, and it goes into counseling as well, because in terms of looking at a counselor's professional identity, racial identity is also a part of that. So asking yourself sort of how you as a clinician are viewing this situation, what part of this are you having trouble with, if any? Those kinds of questions are really going to come into the fray, I think, for years to come. And to some degree, it's just really going to be based on this one isolated event as being sort of the spark to some of that. So in terms of counselor involvement, I think the counselors – I know for a fact that tomorrow in Ferguson they're going to be having counselors come in and do some in-service training with their teachers and their faculty and staff at the school district, trying to get the students ultimately back into the school. So they're involved in that way, which is really good that they call on counselors to come in and do some of that. But also in terms of the community, just letting people know that you're there. I mean, the minority attrition rate in counseling is still pretty high, and this type of a situation, if counselors aren't careful, it really isn't going to do anything to help that. It'll probably hurt that even more.
And you, as a man from the area, and who is also a counselor, who is also African American. Has it changed you watching these kinds of things?
You know, for me, I don't really think so. I think that like I said, this is going to be bad to say on a podcast, but I've actually never called the police. I'm around 40 years old now. I've never called the police. It's not that I haven't been in situations where I could have used them to serve in some sort of mediator role. I've had situations that's occurred, but I've chosen not to do it simply because of my distrust. I've had encounters over the years with police. I can remember several when I was younger, and just I'm a bigger guy, so if anyone's ever met me in person,
I'm a bigger guy,
so I don't usually get intimidated very easily. But I can remember being a teenager and being in situations where you're in an alley somewhere, something behind your house, and you're encountered by the police, and I mean just immediate fear and just concern, overwhelming. That becomes overwhelming for you. So I've actually never called the police. I've always sort of feared that if I called them, that I would in some way be on their radar.
Or you might get hurt.
Yeah. So it hasn't really changed me much. I think what I found really interesting is the sort of this great generational social divide that we're witnessing in Ferguson. So so when you go back there, what you see is you see many of the older population, the older African American population, and many white allies there as well. And these daytime protests, and they're going around, and they're very peaceful and very engaging, and a lot of good information is going back and forth. And you see it sort of switch at night to the youth. The youth then come out at night, and they're it's a lot more aggressive and a lot more challenging. And I see that, and it. I wasn't around during the civil rights era, but I've seen videos and, of course, read stories and things like that. But I see it being really similar to some of the dynamics that you saw then. It's almost like the young generation really wants more immediate, swift, often even retaliatory action to take place, where you see the older generation just sort of calling for calm and things of that nature. So I'm seeing that, and that has been probably the most surprising and interesting aspects of how all of this has unfolded.
No, in counseling, we speak of concepts such as oppression, racial identity, multiculturalism, social justice. How are these concepts being demonstrated in Ferguson?
Well, another one of my criticisms of the profession, particularly in terms of multiculturalism, is that a lot of the terms often are used in so many ways that they almost it's sort of a false sense of them being ubiquitous, and many people really don't have a good grasp on what many of those concepts are, even though we talk about them often. For example, oppression is something that even in our profession isn't really well defined, although everyone sort of thinks they know what it is
and use it a lot.
We talk about it a lot, and we don't really have it as this well-defined concept. Some have done better than others in terms of defining it, but overall, it's sort of ubiquitous seeming, but not really. So all of these things are really at play in St. Louis. You're seeing social justice come out when individuals are going out and they're protesting and being involved in that way. You're seeing them fight, and there are protesters standing outside of the district attorney's office and things of that nature, the prosecutor's office and things of that nature. So you're seeing that come into play. You're seeing multiculturalism in a variety of contexts, both, again, from the white allies and the black protesters that are standing hand in hand and really making an attempt to try to bring attention to this issue. You're seeing a lot of, in terms, I like to look at racial identity development personally. That's a very meaningful concept for me, but I see a lot of it there playing out in tremendous ways. Again, many of the young protesters who sort of see the police as just this enemy, many of them are sort of in that people of color immersion phase, where you see those individuals getting into more ethnocentric ways of looking at the world, and anyone who's not us is a problem. As a matter of fact, I had a white colleague that was talking about going to protest and actually being assaulted during protests, and having other black protesters come to his aid, things of that nature. I mean, those things are occurring, and you're seeing a lot of that frustration on both sides. I mean, I have I've seen shared comments on social media is a fascinating dynamic to all of this.
Especially now.
Yeah, you're seeing whether you're black or white, if you have friends that come from both environments, you're seeing sort of these posts that may come from some of your white friends that are in support of the police and in support of these things, where if you have a good amount of black friends on your social media, it's all on the other side. And mm-hmm. you're really seeing a lot of these divides come into play here. And I think that is causing a lot of dissonance for people. I mean, it's just a constant discomfort. It's almost like an analogy would be seeing Ferguson as the car wreck on the side of the road, and you're going by it, and you're driving slow, and you're watching it, and you almost can't take your eyes off of it, but traffic keeps moving. And what's happening for people is that they are uncomfortable for that minute. They're uncomfortable seeing the person being pulled from the car, but traffic keeps moving. My hope ultimately is that this dissonance isn't something that allows you to keep moving. My hope ultimately is that this dissonance is something that makes you want to stop and makes you want to get out and makes you want to help the people that are in the car, makes you want to be there with them to get them to a place to where they need to be. And I'm using that analogy to really speak to this community and again other communities across the United States. It really is the same if not the same dynamic that's playing out all across the United States, particularly in large minority communities and having a largely white police force. Yeah, that's sort of how I see some of these concepts coming into play.
It's not just something we talk about today. It's something that you're seeing coming into play.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that people who have studied these things, you can see it pretty much everywhere you go in Ferguson. Mm-hmm. You see differing levels again. I can only imagine what the black police officers in that area go through, are going through right now. I mean, that conflict, and sort of seeing themselves in the middle. And I got a message from a person who used to be a black police officer the other day, and in the St. Louis area, and she was just talking about how difficult it is to sort of be pulled in both directions and feel connected in both directions and sort of feel like she's betraying both sides. And I, again, that's where you see a lot of this come out.
What do you see as the role of professional counseling professionals in order to combat and prevent situations like this from happening in the future? What's our role to combat and prevent situations like this happening in the future?
Well, I think that we have to, like you were saying, take it from being something that is conceptual and be much more deliberate about what we're doing as a profession. So deliberate at the association level, the regional association level. We could use Ferguson as an example. I mean, we could figure out ways to make our associations actually go out into the community and do sensitivity training for police officers, have community forums for police officers and minority constituents, those kinds of things. From our perspective, serving in more of that mediator role, I mean, I think that's something that counselors have been trained to do. They can do those things pretty easily. Making ourselves as professionals more visible during these types of times, also warning and letting people know about the potential impact of these kinds of things. I don't know how many people I've talked to that tell me, I don't know what to tell my children. I don't know what to tell my children in terms of when they go outside. I mean, those are things that counselors are ultimately going to have to deal with down the road. What do I tell my son when he encounters the police officer? He wanted to be a police officer. Now he thinks police officers are bad and out to harm him. Yeah, my son has nightmares about the police officers that from watching the news. Those kinds of questions have to be confronted, and I think counseling is a great place to deal with some of those things. So,
how old are your children?
My son is 7 right now. I have a daughter that's 6, and I have another daughter that's about to be 2 in a few days.
Oh.
And
so what are, you know, what kinds of questions are they asking Daddy? And more importantly, what kinds of opportunities are you taking to teach them at this point?
Oh, wonderful. I'm glad you're letting me talk about that.
Yeah.
We go to St. Louis often, so we go to St. Mm-hmm. Louis as a family. I mean, we'll be in St. Louis. We could be there up to 4 times a month mm-hmm. on different weekends. So we're there often. Now, the town that I live in currently has a very sparse black population, so there's not a lot of diversity.
Mm-hmm.
So when we go to St. Louis, we're often driving up Interstate 70, and as you go from deeper out into the county, and you see these white faces and cars around you, and you're going into the city, basically you're able to, on the highway, see the segregation and see the separation mm-hmm. occur just in a normal drive into the city. So my son, I've read research that suggests, that developmental research that suggests that racial identity development really doesn't start to take shape until later into early adolescence. But I'm a firm believer that very similar to gender identity development, racial identity development occurs pretty early on, like age 3, 4, people start to understand the differences that are there.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that was a side note. My son has asked me on a couple of occasions, Dad, why are there no more white people around us anymore? Like, he looks around. And
as you drive in.
As we're driving.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
so he wants to know, where do all the white people go? Like,
mm-hmm.
do they not drive anymore in this area? And I've explained to him, no, they don't, most white people don't live here. So when you're seeing white people usually in this area, they are driving to a Cardinal game, or they're driving to some sort of other function that's downtown. They're usually not driving in to stop or driving in to visit, those kinds of things. So those have been discussions that we've had to have and him try to figure out in terms of his own racial identity, where he fits in with some of these,
mm-hmm.
these things. Having questions about, again, the town that I live in doesn't have a lot of diversity. So asking questions about where are all the black people now?
Mm-hmm.
Where are they at? Why don't they come out to restaurants and these kinds of questions? So
yeah.
we have those discussions all the time. And I don't know. I think we probably have them more than other families, and I'm comfortable having them, and my wife, we're both comfortable having them.
And that may be why you have them so much.
It may be.
You have a lot of comfort with it, yeah.
So, yeah, they ask those questions often, and you see, I see them really having some discomfort with things, and sort of, I don't want to get too deep into analogies,
mm-hmm.
but their newness to having these discussions, I think that's sort of where we are professionally as well as mental health clinicians. So these discussions have to occur. We have to allow them to make us uncomfortable. We have to
mm-hmm.
allow them to challenge us in those ways. We have to sort of embrace that dissonance
mm-hmm.
and allow it to grow into something that is actually meaningful and helpful and mm-hmm. and promotes change. My kids are really funny. My daughter, she listens to all of that stuff, and she'll ask a question here and there. But my son is just he furls his eyebrows, and he gets real serious about asking the questions about where are all the white people now.
Yeah.
I
grew up in a Hispanic neighborhood. Even though I'm Caucasian, I grew up in a Hispanic neighborhood. And I remember taking my children back there to L.A., and I remember my son saying, Mom, are all of the windows rolled up? I mean, did you lock the doors? Like you could tell
right.
he was a little afraid.
Right.
And he said, look at that house over there. I said, honey, that house over there is Sally Barcenas' house. I know
right.
her. That's what's the problem here? But then I realized that they just really, like your children, come from a different neighborhood where they live.
Right.
So it behooves us, doesn't it, to, you know, somehow have our children come to an understanding with all of this.
Well, if we don't, we do them a disservice. I mean,
yeah.
we are letting them go out into the world with these misconceptions about how things actually occur. We allow them to ultimately, if we don't have the conversations, they contribute to the oppression of the groups that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So, we don't want that. I mean, that's sort of, I think, the the charge that we have as people who understand some of these dynamics. We have to
right.
push it. We have to go out and make other people somewhat uncomfortable with
the
discussion.
We have to have the discussion.
The discussions are the starting point.
Yeah, the discussions are the starting point. You mentioned dissonance a while back. Why is this discomfort such an important aspect to change in these situations?
Well, I think that before that, and this is coming again from my racial identity background, it really is that's the first step. Before that, you really are somewhat oblivious. I mean, you see these things. I've dealt with my students. Again, my program is in an area where it's mostly Caucasian. We rarely have any diverse students that come through the program. So their experience with me as a black faculty member, it's their first experience with a black educator ever. So we have to have the discussions that color blindness isn't a great thing. Your obliviousness to these issues isn't a great thing. Hopefully by the end of this class, you're going to actually understand that when you go out to Walmart, you're going to see things differently and be uncomfortable with some of these things. So dissonance brings people out of obliviousness. However, it's not adequate to get people to actually change. It's not adequate to get people to act, because what happens with dissonance, just like any kind of dissonance that we have in life, we allow ourselves the privilege of rationalizing, making justification for why these things aren't so bad, why these things are universalized. So the dissonance is a great fire. It's a great starting point,
right.
But it's not enough. It's something that we have to be diligent as a profession with for our students and for our professionals, that we have to continue to push them in a direction where they are understanding that this is something that has to continue to be talked about, has to continue to be understood by professionals who are doing this work.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell them that whether you're working with you're a white counselor and you're working with a white client, you are not the same, and to assume that you're the same is actually doing them quite a disservice culturally. There has to be some discomfort there to get you to even want to learn more about them, to get you to understand that you have a deficit there. So I think you have to have it in order for it to lead to something. But I also think that as uncomfortable as dissonance is, as uncomfortable as engaging in the process of self-awareness ultimately is, the best thing for it is for a while to let that dissonance sort of fester in individuals and fester in communities and lead to something greater. Because we're really good. We're really good, particularly at the individual level, of just letting it go. That's not a big deal. It's not. Maybe it wasn't because I'm
a
woman.
But okay.
Right? Yeah. Maybe it's not because I'm a woman that I make 72 cents to the dollar in Illinois. No. Maybe it's something else. Right. Those kinds of questions. And by letting them go, we add to the problem. So I am a big stickler for this. I want to make people uncomfortable with this, not to be annoying or come from a position where it's promoting me being pejorative in any sense. I want you to get to a place to where you are uncomfortable enough to want to do something about it.
And
that
we
conflict,
should look
I think,
at dissonance in ourselves. We talk to our clients about it all the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, it's a part of our life, too. Will you be talking about Ferguson with your students, or have you already?
We just started class yesterday, so we will, absolutely. We'll be talking about it then. I'm planning on going back again this weekend and just sort of mingling around with people and see what's going on. And so I'll have probably a little bit more information to share.
Why has it continued? So there's sometimes, child is killed somewhere, and we get upset for a little while, and then it's over very quickly.
Right.
Why is Ferguson continuing?
Ferguson is unique. It's really unique. Like I said, it's one of those environments where there has already been racial tension. I'll self-disclose a little bit. Don't know if I should even be doing name dropping or anything like that on ACA, So their old superintendent, they recently had hired a black superintendent for the first time in the district's history in Ferguson, Florissant. So that guy that was a superintendent, I actually graduated high school with. So he was there. He was a black superintendent, and he was recently pushed into resignation. And it was this big racial firestorm within Ferguson, Florida. This has all been occurring in the last 2 years, right? So, and then to have this situation with this young man shot, on top of that is really a situation with the superintendent that had really not boiled over yet. I think that's part of it. I think that sort of there's a history there in that community, particularly in the last 5 or 6 years, where there has been this growing concern with how the police are working with the citizens and just how everything in the school system is playing out. And it's sort of been festering for a while now, and you're seeing some of the ramifications of it. There are also other dynamics at play as well, and part of it is that there's a wide educational disparity in Ferguson. I mean, there are people that Ferguson has like $300,000 houses. They also have what's called Section 8 housing. So it's a wide disparity in terms of income and educational level there. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing some of that actually play out in some of the ways that people are going about exercising their frustration as well.
Interesting. My next question is, and I know you have concerns as I do, what are your concerns for children who experience or witness some of these situations that have gone on in Ferguson? You've talked about your children, but the children who actually are living in the area are witnessing some of this, are perhaps fearful. What are your concerns for these children?
Well, I think that ultimately there have to be discussions, again, not only among adults but also with the children, and talking about some of their fears and talking about some of their concerns and encouraging them to express some of those things. Because what happens with this is and what happens with some of the dissonance is that these children, they don't necessarily understand where even to place their frustration. Their frustration may be toward white police officers. Their frustration may be toward the only other white people that they see, their white teachers, things of that nature. Their frustration may be with their parents for not doing more. It may be displaced. They may be frustrated with parents for not doing more to protect them from these things. So so these questions, I mean, they may lead for clinicians to very interesting dynamics that are occurring that ultimately are bringing these individuals into your office. On a different note, a related note, your comfort as a clinician with dealing with these things and not simply dismissing them like other individuals may. Will be the difference between whether or not you have a client who has successful outcomes or whether or not you have attrition. So it's extremely important for our profession to understand this. And again, this type of thing, it's not just necessarily just isolated to Ferguson. People are seeing this all around the world and having responses to it all around the world. So
it's amazing. It's a little bit of a firestorm.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. What are the potential future implications for counselors resulting from Ferguson and/or situations like Ferguson?
Well, I think the biggest thing is we're going to have to watch out for is the increased distrust between individuals that come from different racial ethnic backgrounds, and understanding that the most of our counselors are white counselors, and many of these clients that are going to be coming in dealing with some of these issues are not going to be white. That distrust really is putting up immediate barriers in relationships, and the counselors who are well versed at being able to discuss these things, that are comfortable discussing these things, they'll be the only ones that will excel with this, and others will do what they've done, and that'll be to blame clients for not being motivated and sort of place the responsibility back on the client for their attrition. So I think there's also, in terms of racial identity development, an increased likelihood with this mistrust, this client attrition, to have an increased likelihood of individuals sort of being more ethnocentric in the way that they see the world, and coming into a white counselor, if we're not seeing you as being an ally, You don't really have anything that you can do to help me. So I think some of that is going to play out, and ultimately it's going to be up to the counselor in terms of what they know about themselves, how comfortable they are and willing they are to discuss these issues and not dismiss them, because the dismissal teaches the client just as much as your willingness. I mean, you're teaching them what can be discussed and what can't be, simply by how you engage them in a session. I mean, it's pretty obvious early on, and even when it's not, I mean, the likelihood is that individuals who are mistrustful anyway are going to assume that you are not willing to talk about those things. So,
And the dismissal will just make them push it down further and
absolutely.
make them more angry.
Yeah, and it dehumanizes people. It basically tells people that they are not worthy of being able to have those discussions. Those discussions aren't important. And for an individual who is in the immersion stage of racial identity development, I mean, that's sort of where they are. That's what they think about it. It's something that is a pervasive part of how they view themselves. So to dismiss it, to dismiss these conversations, is basically dismissing all of who they are. So.
And it's not working on trust and being open to where the client is, to meeting
Absolutely.
them where they are. Going back to Carl Rogers once again, we go,
Right. Absolutely.
meeting your client where they are, and working more maybe on trust. Some people think that they can gain trust in one session. Well, maybe it's going to take longer at
Right.
times like this.
Absolutely.
Well, this has been really a fascinating conversation. I would like to give you a chance right now to give us some closing remarks. I think everything you've said has been really, really interesting, and there will be people will be able to write to you. They can write to me, and I will make sure everything gets to
Oh,
you.
wonderful.
And so anyway, why don't you give us some closing remarks?
Well, I will, in closing, just like to challenge all the counseling professionals that are listening to this to really question yourself. Do a little bit of self-reflection to figure out where you are with what you're seeing in Ferguson and in protests around the country. Where you are in terms of your stance on this, where you are in terms of your willingness to discuss these things with clients that may come in and want to talk to you about issues related to race, issues related to their ethnicity, issues related to their place in the world, and just try to figure out your own comfort level in dealing with that. I'm hoping that there's a little bit of discomfort there. I'm sort of selfishly hoping that there's a little bit of discomfort there, and that I would love for that discomfort to fester for a while and turn into something that is meaningful, turn into ultimately something that is actionable on your part, that makes you want to go out and learn a little bit more and engage a little bit more these individuals that we're seeing and understand that there's a lot to be learned from the situation that is occurring in Ferguson. Of course, we're all hoping that there are positive outcomes, that no one else loses their life, that the protests they end up sort of becoming minimalized and people are going back to leading regular daily lives. But at the same time, again, I'm selfishly hoping that this turns into something for people to really latch on to and say, I allowed this to change me. I allowed this to make me more conscious of what's going on, more critically conscious of what I'm seeing on a daily basis. So that's my hope for the profession. I hope that we can come to some sort of place of action that comes out of what we're seeing here and understand our role as a profession in dealing with many of these issues.
And the willingness to be uncomfortable.
The willingness to be uncomfortable, absolutely.
So important and so difficult to do. But anyway, thank you so much, Dr. Ken Oliver, for joining us today to discuss the situation in Ferguson. To view links to this program, to write to the presenter or the host, please go to www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page. This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the ACA 2014 podcast series, signing off.